You know those little church surveys that we hand out once in a while? Bob McCurdy maybe is in the one mostly running that. The last Atlanta and Buford church survey finished with the question, do you have any subjects you'd like to hear covered on the Sabbath during a message? And I saw one question was, how do we know we're God's people? How do we know we're God's people? There were no names associated with the questions. It's just a list that Dr. Ross sent around. We're entering the time of year when we most know that we're God's people, I believe, in very important ways. As the holy season begins, as God's plan is logically, sequentially laid out before us. But first, before going that direction, there are a lot of churches out there. I remember asking my mom as a little boy, how do we know we're going to the right one? And we were in a mainstream church, and she just said, we do our best to go to the one that teaches the most correctly. How do we know we're going to the right church? When I lived in Virginia, I worked with a veterinarian, not very closely, but she was just at the college. And her husband was a builder, and they devoutly attended the local Christian church about a quarter mile from my house. I could walk out the back door on my deck, and this was in the Appalachian Mountains, and it was really pretty in Blacksburg, and there was a valley down and a little rise up, and there sat that church out on North Main Street, which was not a developed street, and as you went a little further down, big drop and then a big climb up Brush Mountain. So I could see that church well. That's where they attended. And they annually took time off from work, and they went on a missions trip, this couple. And one day they decided to sell their house and donate the sales to a missions project and join as missionaries to Africa. It's a true story. Big house they had. Lots of horses. Nice life. Why? Why did they do that? Because, and this is the husband's words, I could no longer bear the thought that even one human being would spend eternity in hell because I didn't come to help, and I could have. That's a godly attitude. And that's the way this couple were, and it's an attitude for which there will be room in God's kingdom one day, I feel sure. How do we know we're in God's church? Because we know God can't bear that thought either. And he has a plan that my friend didn't know about to save the majority of his children and not lose them, which was the fear of this couple that sold their house. And God has revealed that plan to his church, how it works. It really is a miracle. And it's all laid out in the holy days that are rapidly approaching. Regarding my Blacksburg friend, there are many churches out there containing many good people. And yet, here we sit today in God's church. And they don't. And they're not there. How did this happen? Why did this happen? It's all clearly explained in God's holy day plan. Sometimes it is a little hard to take in, isn't it? When we think about it, being selectively picked out by God, first fruits, why is it hard to take in? Because we all know deep inside who we are. We're just people, not all that worthy, all that special, all that great, yet here we are. Before going further, let's consider two things about that. First Corinthians and first chapter of that book. As we sit here today, 1 Corinthians 1 and verses 27 to 29. Why are we here? But God has chosen the foolish people. It says things, it means people, the foolish people of the world, to put to shame the wise. And God has chosen the weak people of the world to put to shame the people who are mighty. And the base people of the world and the people who are despised, God has chosen. And the people which are not, to bring to nothing those that are great, those that are greater, that no flesh should glory in his presence. We are in no way here because we're better than others. Could I compare myself to my friend who sold his house and went to Africa? You know, I've not done anything comparable. But nonetheless, what makes God's people different from very admirable other people who are out there? Matthew 13 and verse 17. Matthew 13:17, Christ's words, "For assuredly I say to you," and this is kind of sobering and it's kind of staggering, "that many prophets and righteous men desired to see what you see," sitting here today, "and to hear," and hear means understand, "and to understand what you understand," and they did not hear it. They did not understand it. What do we have that my friend lacked? Verse 45 of this same chapter. "Again, the kingdom of heaven is like a merchant seeking beautiful pearls, who when he found one pearl," this is God's truth, this is God's kingdom, "one pearl of great price, he went and he sold everything he had to hang on to that pearl of great price. He sold all that he had and he bought it." The truth is more valuable than everything else we could ever physically have. It's part of our calling into God's church, and it's what separates us from all other churches out there. I did gain enough exposure to the missionary trip supported by that church I mentioned up on the rise behind my house to know a bit about how they function. Two of my kids went on those trips, one to Peru and one to the back country of Jamaica. They went with essentially no training. Is this how we send ministers out into the field? Not really the best. Gave brief plays depicting the life and death of Christ for interested locals who might be walking by each evening. And then they spoke with anyone willing to sit with them and ask if they wanted to give their lives to Christ. And all who answered yes, many for my daughter who went to Peru couldn't even speak English, the language of the play, but all who answered yes were considered saved. Yet without knowing anything about God's plan, about the holy days, the Sabbath and all that it means, about the wonder of the spirit family that God is creating for all eternity. So how did I get going on this track today, this pathway? It was actually a movie I was watching that got me started. My title today is, "How Do We Know We're God's Church?" And as I was watching this movie, I just thought, there are so many reasons. How are we different? What do we really have that others don't? And this movie reminded me of how special God's church really is. And lest it seem different in any way, let me reiterate, many people out there strongly desire the truth and are better than me in so many ways. Yet God knows the best time to call. And somehow, for some reason, here we sit today. Here we all sit. This movie was called The Ledge. I really didn't know anything about it. I was sitting on my bed. I was tired. It was Netflix. Looked like something that might be interesting. It was netflix.com/watch/ and then some long number for the movie. But if you search on The Ledge, you would find it. It wasn't really all that great. I don't know that I would encourage that. But I'll continue with dialogue between Joe, a devout mainstream Christian who felt he needed to be a local missionary and save people for the same reason as my Virginia friend, and Gavin, an atheist two doors down from Joe's apartment, who wanted no part in the conversation or of God, not interested, the God he was sure didn't exist. And Gavin didn't know what was coming. He and his roommate were simply invited in for dinner. So here's some of the dialogue. Joe speaking, "Let me ask you, Gavin, you ever look around and the world just seems empty to you?" Gavin, "Oh yeah," emphasizing, still in the dark as to where Joe is going. "Joe, did it ever occur to you that maybe it's because you don't have God in your life?" Gavin, "Nope," shaking his head, looking matter of fact. And Joe says, "Never?" And Gavin, now he's got the point. He knows why he's there. He says, "Look, Joe, when I was a kid, I totally believed in God." So he came out of a religious background. "But you know, you grow up. I looked around, I said, Santa Claus, no evidence. The Tooth Fairy, no evidence. God, same thing to me, no evidence." And then you think, I wonder if I really need all these imaginary friends. Joe, "So you think God's just a pleasant thing? Like it's easier to believe than not to believe?" And Gavin says, "Well, easier for you, obviously." Joe says, "No, Gavin, faith is hard. God tests you time and again. Sometimes he even demands that you die for him. You think that's easy?" Gavin, "Unfortunately, too often it is. That's the problem. Like I could never fly a jet into a building. But those 9/11 guys could because they believed in an afterlife." Joe, "What did God do to you to make you so angry at him? Look at the world he created. All the beauty." And here we go with the difficult questions for so many churches. Gavin, responding to all that beauty in this creation, wars, plagues, genocides, earthquakes, tidal waves, and then after all that suffering, you know, look around out there. After all that suffering, what does your God do next? He sends most of us to hell. Gavin's word, "This is a real problem for mainstream Christianity. This is what modern churches teach and believe. Yet it's not part of God's plan at all, as is clearly spelled out and pictured in the holy days." Joe's response to this, then he sends all of us to hell. "Not if you're born again. You have to accept Jesus Christ as your Lord and Savior. That is your only entrance requirement." Gavin, "Okay." And then he continues with the problem, hitting Joe with the problem for modern churches that they have no answer for. Gavin says, "So the Jews, the Hindus, the Muslims, the atheists, the Buddhists, they're all condemned to hell, right?" And Joe says, "They have to accept Jesus Christ." And Gavin, knowing something about religion, "And the Catholics? There's a lot of Catholics out there, Joe. You believe they're not born again, right?" Joe, "Right." Gavin, "Let's face it, man. It doesn't make sense." And you know what? He's right. It doesn't make sense. It's what I grew up with. And Joe says, "Yes, it does. That's the beauty of eternal salvation. You see, anyone can go to heaven or hell because anyone can be saved. It's your choice." Gavin, here we go again. Get something fully answered by God's holy day plan. Gavin says, "Well, it's your choice unless you're a kid in China who gets hit by a bus and never even heard of this getting saved deal. Where's his choice?" Stepping aside for a moment, most of you know, I didn't grow up in God's church. I was about 18 when I first made contact. I never attended a church that could answer that question. Where's that kid's choice? And so forth, before entering God's church. God will offer the pearl of great price to the Chinese boy, to all humans who have ever lived, either now or in the second resurrection. Where do we find this message? It's in the holy days, the spring harvest, the fall harvest, the last great day. How do we know God's church is really God's church? No one else has this immeasurably valuable truth. Amazing. It's amazing when we really understand what God is doing in His church. As part of this, it's important to recognize that we're not called into God's church for our salvation. If we think about it, that is part of what God's working to accomplish, but it's not the main part. If God was just interested in our salvation, there's nothing wrong with the second resurrection. That would work just fine. As I've mentioned before, there's nothing wrong with that. We're here by invitation to help with the coming very major fall harvest. In His church today, God is preparing a people. That's really what we're called for at this time. Back to Joe, the conversation, well, that's why it's so important, and he's referring to the boy in China, to spread the gospel, try and save people. This being the same conclusion of my Virginia friend. Think about what that means, though, really. That the salvation, the eternity of endless millions of remote humans, many of whom we can't begin to reach, rests in our hands rather than God's hands. And God's timing, and God's calling. You could think of an 18-month-old child in the Amazon jungle who got a fever and died. My church had no idea in the world how to answer the question, what happens to them? Without a second resurrection, without a fall harvest, without... Well, the obvious answer is you can't send them to hell. So they get a free ticket into heaven, but that, it just doesn't work. Back to Gavin. I'm sorry, Joe, I don't mean to laugh. I just find this incredible, shaking his head. And Joe says, you know, maybe I'm just viewing God from a different angle. And Gavin said, what angle would that be? And Joe says, well, I go to the hospital and I visit sick children, right? 2 days ago, I was at the bedside of a dying child. His mother and father were killed in an automobile accident. He's about to die as well. And he asked me if heaven really exists. I say, yes, it does. It's where your mom and dad are. About an hour later, he dies with a smile on his face. So what would you have said in my place, Gavin? Sorry, kid. No God. No heaven. Gavin. No, I probably would have told him the same lie that you did. But Joe, I'll tell you one thing I sure wouldn't have said, and that's, I'm sorry, kid, you're going to hell because you haven't been baptized. Wow. That was the movie. It was. It struck me in a number of ways. There are very major dilemmas for modern churches, and I grew up wondering about all of them, too. I really did. It's just, I don't understand how this could work. But how do we know we're in God's church? How do we know we're really different? That all those humans aren't going to suffer forever in hell? I jumped a line. How do we know we're really different? And the answer is because you, can answer the huge, inescapable concern that my Blacksburg friend had that led him to sell his house, and this is that all those humans that he just has to reach really aren't going to suffer for all endless eternity just because he couldn't get there and help convert them. And rather than joining the mission effort, he felt compelled to join. As gallant and truly admirable as that was, our missionary effort is different right now. We need to be pouring our efforts and our prayers into the truth into which we've been called, preparing to teach endless millions of Gavins and Joes and Chinese and Amazon children out there who have never heard it. you can answer every question raised by Gavin, every criticism, and we understand that Joe, despite the strongest of convictions otherwise on his part, is described by God in Matthew 13:17 that we already read. Many a righteous man desires to see what you see and to understand what you understand, and they don't. That day will come for all of them, but for now, Joe totally lacked correct answers, and when he attempted to answer, gave arguments that were fundamentally opposed to God's word and God's truth, and he found himself backed up against a wall that he couldn't get around or get over. Yet all solved by what God reveals in his holy day plan. The only real hope for this world is that holy day plan. Are we lucky to have the only real hope that this world has in our minds, made clear to us by God? Let's consider this as we prepare to enter the spring holy days. I'm going to quote from our booklet, The Fundamental Beliefs of the United Church of God. I think there's probably a bunch of them on the table over there. Page 34, The Festivals of God. We believe in the commanded observance of the 7 annual festivals that were given to ancient Israel by God, were kept by Jesus Christ, the apostles, and the New Testament church, and will be observed by all mankind during Christ's millennial rule. These festivals reveal God's plan of salvation. Today I only have time to briefly focus on the approaching spring holy days. We could do the same thing with the fall holy days, but given our time of year, as we're inching closer to the spring days, how does the keeping of these holy days, the first 3 days picturing God's plan of salvation, tell us that we're in the right church? The Passover is almost upon us. Beginning sundown, April 21st this year, the first of God's 7 annual festivals listed in Leviticus 23. How are we different? How do we keep that day? What do we believe? I can't tell you how many happy Easters I endured this past week. I live in a really Catholic world at work, and it's so strong. But in all the churches we pass, you see Easter Sunday, welcome, and I was talking with Jackie coming in. I don't know if it's more of a new dress, white gloves, have fun day is what it's become, and we're having an Easter egg hunt today. But what do we believe? How are we different? The modern church has replaced Passover with Easter Sunday, and it's tomorrow. Yesterday was, quote, Good Friday. How many things are just overtly wrong with the modern church's cherished Easter season? To mention a few, Easter is named after a pagan sun fertility goddess to whom people used to sacrifice their children. That's a big one. Easter then teaches that Christ rose on a Sunday morning. My daughter Katie sent a little thing last week. It's a timeline of Christ's death in what they call Passion Week. It's by Jesus.org. Find answers about Jesus Christ. A timeline of the Easter week. And here we reach Friday and all the trials that Christ went through. And on Friday at about 3 o'clock p.m., Christ was killed. Christ died. And then that day ends. Jesus was buried by sundown. So that's Good Friday yesterday that we just passed in the modern world. Jesus was gotten into the grave just in time before the Sabbath started. And then Sunday it says Jesus Christ rises from the dead before dawn. Before dawn. The modern church's Good Friday crucifixion and Easter Sunday resurrection provide a very short piece of time on Friday. during which Christ was not yet in the grave, a piece of sunlight on that day, one full daytime period on Saturday, and by tradition, just the very dawn of Sunday, just a small piece of light there. What's wrong with this? What's so very wrong with this doctrine? We're in Matthew, if you're still there. Go to Matthew 12. Matthew 12 and verses 38 to 40. Then some of the scribes and Pharisees answered, saying, "Teacher, we want to see a sign from you." They had heard about a lot of them. But he answered and said to them, "An evil and adulterous generation seeks after a sign, and no sign will be given to it except the sign of the prophet Jonah. For as Jonah was 3 days and three nights," and we could go back and review Jonah, and we can show ourselves this means three full days and three full nights here in the belly of the great fish, "so will the Son of Man be 3 days and three nights in the heart of the earth." Where do we get 3 days and three nights? Between a Friday burial that happens just before dark and a Sunday resurrection that occurs at or very close to dawn. The 3 days are counted as a little piece of light on Friday, as a full day of light on Saturday, and then as a glimmer of light on Sunday morning. And that's contradictory to what Christ says here, but even if we accept that, what's really wrong with this scenario? What's really wrong with it? How many nights are there between Friday evening and Sunday morning? Christ being put in a grave just before dark on Friday. You have Friday night and you have Saturday night, and then comes Sunday morning. There's only two nights in there. This doesn't work no matter how much you try. Even if you could count a few minutes on Sunday as a full day of light, what does John 20 verse 1 tell us? Let's look in John. John 20 verse 1. "Now on the first day of the week," so this is Sunday, "Mary Magdalene went to the tomb early while it was still dark and saw that," wait a second, what did I just read? "While it was still dark." She's there before the sun came up, so we even lack that piece of sunlight on Sunday to count that as a daytime period. "Mary Magdalene went to the tomb early while it was still dark and saw that the stone had been taken away from the tomb." It wasn't light yet, and Christ was gone. There are not 3 days and three nights between Good Friday evening and Easter Sunday morning, no matter how you count. The world's Easter, and boy, is it popular. I'm feeling more ostracized every year as I don't do this. The world's Easter rejects the only sign Christ said he would give of his true identity. And as such, labels those churches that keep Easter rather than God's Passover as, I'm afraid, false churches, even though they're sincere. They don't mean to be. This is part of the Babylonian mystery religion. These are daughter churches of that system. They've lost the Passover, the true memorial of a God being spilling his own precious blood for his children, for our salvation. Jesus' death occurred on the afternoon of the 14th of Abib, which was a Wednesday that year. His resurrection was just before dark on the Sabbath day that year, the date of our Passover. It happened, or it opened the door to our eternity, our spirit life as children of the Almighty God Himself. And the modern churches have unwittingly, unknowingly lost the Passover. We never talked about it when I was there, but it was traded for a season that rejects the only sign Christ gave of who He really is, and for a day named after a pagan sun goddess. In contrast, the holy day season begins by immediately showing us the truth and the very deep meaning of God's Passover, a festival that is still to be kept. So the Passover is immediately followed by the days of unleavened bread. The Passover is a renewal of our baptism, our commitment to God, a very important annual event. With the Passover each year, we are cleansed from the dirty feet we pick up moving through that year, from sin that affects all humans, including us. If correctly kept, we leave the Passover in the same state as coming up out of our baptism, sinless. What do we want to do when God returns us to that state? We want to put sin out of our lives, the sin that is so hurtful to this world. Practice God's way of life. Follow Christ's example. The Feast of Unleavened Bread pictures what? I'm going to return to our fundamental beliefs booklet. This time, page 34. The Festival of Unleavened Bread, starting the day after Passover and continuing for 7 days, teaches us that Jesus Christ leads us to reject lawlessness. Sin is breaking of the law. And we should reject that during this time. The days of unleavened bread teach us that Jesus Christ leads us to reject lawlessness, repent of sin, and live by every word of God. The modern church teaches, however, lawlessness. They teach that the law is gone. You don't have to worry about it. Christ paid the price. Adultery, murder, they're not really laws anymore. I never could get my head around that as a Baptist, but that's what we said. If you want to be sure you're part of God's church, let's be sure that we do not enter this state of lawlessness. God's law is done away with. It's nailed to the cross. That's what we were taught. The Ten Commandments are no longer commanded. Does this even remotely make sense? Let's look in Exodus 20. God's law, Exodus 20. In verse 1, and God spoke all these words, saying, so this isn't Moses' law, this is God's law. Verse 3, you shall have no other gods before me. Verse 4, don't make idols and worship them, no carved images. Verse 7, you shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain. I love you too much. You should love me. This is the way the system is going to work in the family I'm building. Verse 12, honor your father and your mother. Verse 13, you shall not murder. Verse 14, you shall not commit adultery. You know, disloyalty is a big thing to God. If we can be disloyal to our spouse, he knows we can to him as well. You shall not steal. You shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. You shall not covet your neighbor's property. That's not yours. That's the root of a lot of trouble. How could these laws possibly be done away with? Well, you know the answer as well as I. They're done away with because of the one I skipped. Verse 8, remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. So if you're not going to keep it, you've got to do away with all of them. They stand or fall as a package. The world has done away with not only the Sabbath, but remarkable as it seems, God's fundamental platform of law and human relationships. The Feast of Pentecost, the Feast of Unleavened Bread, is the day when Christ teaches us to reject lawlessness. And the modern church does teach that the law is gone. And if you want to be sure you're part of God's true church, let's be sure to not enter lawlessness, to follow 1 John. Let's go to 1 John. 1 John 2 and verse 4. He who says, I know him, and we're referring to God, and does not keep his commandments is a liar, and the truth is not in him. 1 John 5, verse 3, same book. 1 John 5, 3, for this is the love of God, that we keep his, God's commandments. This is the central message of the Feast of Unleavened Bread, the Festival of Unleavened Bread, and of the spring festivals. The last spring holy day is Pentecost. Is there a message in this festival that the modern churches just don't have? Well, there sure is. A message that is so important, it's impossible to not label it as part of the pearl of great price. And God has given that priceless gift to His church. I never even heard of it in all my years in the Baptist church. And now Feast of Pentecost. It's an annual, reading again from our Fundamental Beliefs book, an annual Sabbath in the late spring, also called the Feast of Weeks or the Feast of Harvest or First Fruits. It teaches us that Jesus Christ is now building His church, comprising those who are a kind of first fruits. Never heard of such a thing. And yet it's all straight from the Bible. In the spiritual harvest of mankind. This is why we're sitting here. God has, in a miracle, called us into His small spring harvest. This holy day teaches us, and let's all pay attention, that Jesus Christ is earnestly working to build His family, starting first with those who will be the first fruits, the first saved in the spiritual harvest of, eventually, all mankind. That's why our church emblem, I think it's here, I can't see around the corner, says preparing a people. And unfortunately, Joe, in the movie I talked about, believed what the Christian world believes and what I was taught, that there is only one day of salvation. The small spring harvest, Pentecost, the huge fall harvest, Feast of Tabernacles, last great day, are concepts that absolutely don't compute and on which Gavin picked up and had criticisms that Joe could not answer. That Christianity really does not make sense. Without the message we're about to start walking through. God's holy day plan for the creation of His spiritual family, there's great learning, great hope, a great future in the plan that we're about to start moving through. Let's enter the Passover this year and the following spring holy days with an eye for the incredible future and truth being selectively laid out before us in these days by our great God.